Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today on the program, Jean Boggio is here to talk about her new book, Stolen Fields, A Story of Eminent Domain and the Death of the American Dream. So this is a memoir and family history of the author's experiences growing up in the 40s and 50s and the devastation that eminent domain had on the entire Cole family. Jean Boggio is a graduate of Allegheny College in Western Pennsylvania with a BA in drama. She holds advanced degrees in education from City College in New York and Rutgers University in New Jersey. She grew up in Ridgewood, New Jersey, and lived much of her adult life in Hutterton County, New Jersey, where she raised her two children. Jean has been an actress, an elementary school teacher, an entrepreneur, a professional quilter, a certified market gardener, a psychiatric nurse, and now she has turned to be an author and a publisher. She now lives in Maine and has several future books planned and will publish them through Colrith Press. So thank you so much for joining us today, Jean.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, Juanita.
Well,
it's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, great, great. Well, congratulations. I mean, this is your first book that you've published. It's always a huge, huge endeavor to get a first book out. And I know I have actually heard that you were selected by Publishers Weekly as one of several books shown on the cover of February's issue. So you must just be thrilled.
Oh, yes. And since then, the book has won a finalist award, actually, with the Indie Book Award for overall design.
Oh, wow. Well, great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You must be just feeling great.
Oh, yes.
So I also understand that you, as well as many of the descendants of the Cole family, will be returning to Neville Island on June 14th of this year, 2008, to celebrate the launch of Stolen Fields?
Yes, yes, we will. we're really looking forward to it. I just picked up the T-shirt today.
Oh, you did.
The back.
Oh, so what's it going to mean to you, Jean, to have all of your family together for this event?
Well, it's not all of them, but it's the ones who were most instrumental in helping with the book. There are several cousins who, while they were supportive, didn't find time in their busy lives to do other than read the book, and that was very good because they gave some very good positive feedback about it. But the ones who were right there with me, that we were in email contact on a day-to-day basis, those cousins will be there.
Oh, that's great.
And my sister.
Oh, wonderful. Well, it's going to be a great reunion all around.
Oh, yes. Forward to it. And I believe the people on Neville Island are looking forward to it as well.
I imagine. How many people actually live there right now?
I don't know total numbers. The island is only 5 miles long and a mile wide, and the whole eastern end where the farms used to be are all factories and various businesses, and it's just, you know, paved over. So all the houses are at the other end. So I really don't know, but you know, maybe a couple thousand people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure.
Well, it's going to be a great event all around. So let's talk a little bit about this whole issue of eminent domain, because, you know, I actually have only heard about eminent domain over the past few years, and I was kind of under the assumption, as maybe many listeners are, that this is what the current administration kind of put into effect. But this goes back a long way. So why don't you clarify for us what eminent domain is, and then give us a little history when it was put into place, what laws are around it, and that sort of thing.
Well, eminent domain is something that was invented by the government at some time in the past to enable them to take over private properties for the public good, supposedly, and the government sets what they consider to be a fair price, which is not necessarily what the fair market price would be. I don't know if it's ever been what the fair market price place would be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure when it started, but it was certainly well in place at the time of World War One when it affected my family, my ancestors.
Had they heard about eminent domain? Do you know? Were you able to find that information?
I really don't know. They probably did. But just like most of us, it's something that happens to somebody else.
Yeah.
So they probably didn't think twice about it until it hit them.
So Stolen Fields is how your family, the Cole family, had their ancestral farm taken. So take us back to how your family originally acquired the land and kind of go into that a little bit in detail. And then how many generations had lived there when it was taken?
Well, the family started in, actually they started in Scotland.
yeah, take us back to that. I mean, they were immigrants.
Yes, they started in Scotland. Everybody was immigrants in those days.
Yes, that's true.
The name of the game. But like so many of the Scots, they came through Maine. Others came through Prince Edward Island and New Brunswick up in Canada because that area looked most like the coast of Scotland.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So they came there first, but many of them stayed. I mean, there's still Bragdons up here. There's tons of Coles up here, but some of them moved on to other things, and my ancestors were among those, and it was the five Cole brothers who left Maine in 1814 and made their way to Pittsburgh, which at that time was called Allegheny City, and it was an up-and-coming, thriving metropolis even then, and they arrived on this lovely island, which was at that time already called Neville Island. It had been called Montour's Island previously. And they purchased 150 acres.
Mm.
And it was all wooded. It was a nice flat island. It was built up of alluvial deposits over the centuries and millions of years. So it was very rich soil. And all the area around it was hilly. But this island was right in the middle of the Ohio River. Very rich land, and they cut the timber at the eastern end on their 150 acres and sold it to the riverboats for fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And once they had paid off the 150 acres, they bought 150 more. So between them all, they had 300 acres.
Wow.
Which with a total of 1,200 acres on the island, they owned a pretty good chunk of the island.
Mm-hmm, that is. That's huge.
But now some of the brothers moved on. Some went west, some went south. But two of those brothers stayed there. And my great-great-grandfather, George Washington Cole, was one of those. And he married Dorcas Bragdon, her family also came down from Maine. And I think they might have sold them some of those 300 acres, as they sold some of it to many of the people that came, because on the map, their farm was right next door to my great-grandfather's farm. So he married her and produced my great-grandfather, Augustus Cole, and then he remained on that farm, and many of his siblings moved on to other things. But again, one brother stayed and lived on the next farm, and finally, when it came down to my grandfather's generation, he was the only one, I believe, that was still there. I think the other coal farm was still there, but his brother, my grandfather's brother, which would have been my great-great-uncle,
mm-hmm.
whatever, he left the island and pursued a career with the railroad.
Okay.
But it was when my grandfather was there, and my great-grandmother was still alive, and I think the farm might have still been in her name, actually, at that point.
Was it all 300 acres?
No, they had sold off some of it.
Okay.
It was probably only maybe about 10, 15 acres.
Okay.
But it was big enough that they had a beautiful house there. It was a very prosperous farm, as were all their neighbors' farms. This was not a poor area.
Right.
My grandfather was to inherit the farm, of course, and they were served with this eviction notice from the government, and that was when my grandfather threatened them with the guns that he was wearing in those days.
So he held them back with guns. He tried to hold them back with guns.
Well, he didn't pull the guns then, but he told them, he just sort of put his, rested his hand on the handle and said, first one up, first one down.
Yeah. Oh, God.
And then he, after they left, my uncle told the story about how he got this old wash tub, and he took the gun and standing very close to the wash tub, shot six holes in it in a circle.
Mm.
And then he set the wash tub out by the road where anybody approaching the house would see it, and set the empty shells down quite a distance from the gun, from the wash tub, to make it look like he was this expert marksman at a distance.
Oh, God.
And that was the warning.
Yeah.
Might come. But he was actually a very nonviolent person.
Yeah.
But they didn't know that.
Okay. Well, you know, it kind of shows to human nature what you can be driven to do when you're threatened and when you're in a situation like that.
Well, they did a lot of things while they were there. My grandfather and my great-grandmother and that oldest uncle were the last holdouts. The other farmers fought back for a while, but they finally, each in turn, packed up and left.
Mm-hmm.
But my grandfather, my great-grandmother, and my oldest uncle remained there. They sent the rest of the family up north to Sandy Lake to my grandmother's mother. And they patrolled, took turns patrolling at night with guns because fires were set. All sorts of things went on.
Oh,
but
gosh.
My uncle and his friend, who was also around there somewhere, had a great time. My uncle was a teenager at the time. He was around 17. And they had a great time doing things like throwing rotted patty pan squash down these water pump things.
Oh.
They sent a couple of steam shovels into the Ohio River because the workmen would leave them there with the fire up, still up in the engine, just leave them running overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And they went home and they would just brace the wheels. Well, they'd go in there and take the braces off the wheels and or whatever makes them go, and pull the throttle back and jump off at the last minute and send them into the river.
What do you think it was that made them fight so strong? Why were they the last ones that were holding up?
Well, they were stubborn Scots,
oh.
For one thing. And they're just ornery. I mean, they'd worked very hard. I mean, my grandfather had a thriving business there, and he wanted just remuneration. That was the big point. I mean, everybody was very much on the bandwagon for the war, because this was the time of World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And the government ostensibly wanted the island to build a munitions plant because it was the only flat area for miles around.
Mm.
And they figured they could just build wharves all around the perimeter of the island and just sort of roll the guns down some sort of contraption that they would come up with, and just that would easily get them to boats, and then they could go right down the Ohio River and into the Mississippi, I think. I'm not sure what the geography is there, but somehow it connects.
Mm-hmm.
If they could get those down to the Gulf ports and off to the war front. So that was supposedly their plan.
Right. And didn't quite go down that way, though.
Hmm?
It didn't quite happen that way, though.
Oh, no, it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
The war ended 6 months later.
Yeah.
After the eviction notices were served.
So all of the land was owned by the government.
Yes. And the farmers were very happy because they all thought, well, gee, now we can come back to our farms. We'll gladly give the money back because it wasn't what they were worth anyway. We want our homes.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the plan that they gave to the government. And they were, in fact, six of them went to Washington to see the Secretary of War. And they were told, no, you'll be welcome to bid on the land, but it's going up for public auction. What happened. Actually, it took 2 years for that auction to take place. And meanwhile, my grandfather and uncle, who sort of hovered around the island, my grandfather got a job as foreman of the Emsworth Dam there in the area, and thought they would be close by when the time came to get the land back, but that, of course, never happened. But the day of the auction, many of the farmers went to the Moose Temple where the auction was held, and my great-grandmother was there, and the newspaper account refers to her as the old woman who dressed in black, a little old woman dressed in black, who sat in the front and kept nodding up the bid when her land went up on the auction block. and she pushed it up. She couldn't beat the opponent, but she pushed it up so that they had to pay almost double for her land.
Oh,
actually,
wow.
Yeah, almost double for her land than they did for any of the other farms.
Oh, wow.
Their opponent was Carnegie Steel.
Yeah.
And the funny thing was that the committee at the outset that was supposed to be supervising this project when it was supposed to be a munitions plant was made up of all high executives of companies that were at that time owned by U.S. Steel, and Carnegie Steel was, of course, one of those.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
You know, you can just read into that there may have possibly been some pretty deep corruption going on there. I'm wondering what your thoughts are as to whether or not the government actually planned to really even build a munitions plant on Neville Island, or if they just wanted that land.
Well, I'm thinking that since it was so close to the armistice, they must have known by that time that things were not going well for the German armies in Europe. They must have known that the handwriting was on the wall at that point, that it was only a matter of time. They were already, the Allied troops were already overrunning France and taking back area after area. And the German government was running scared. They were ill-equipped, ill-manned at that point, and they had to know that this war was not going to last.
That it was ending. Mm-hmm. But that's prime land there on Neville Island.
Oh, yeah, it was.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it obviously looks very, very different today.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, at the time, I mean, they raised asparagus. Most of the farms there raised asparagus, among other things. And that asparagus was shipped all over the East Coast. It was shipped to New York City and served at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel as asparagus a la Neville Island.
Oh, really?
So it was famous. And, of course, all the restaurants in Pittsburgh used it. And my grandfather sold many of his crops, not only the asparagus but other things, wholesale in the city of Pittsburgh. And one of his best wholesale customers was H.J. Heinz.
Oh, is that right?
And in fact, the family story goes that Grandpa gave H.J. Heinz our family ketchup recipe. So you can think that when you're eating Heinz ketchup, it really could be Cole ketchup.
It could be Cole ketchup.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. There is some deep history that goes back in your family. That's so interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know that your family at one time owned such a large piece of Neville Island. I mean, were they very affluent? I mean, what was their status at that time?
Their status was pretty high on the island. My
great
grandmother, Mary Ann Cole, was a very forceful woman, and she ran the house and the farm like a tight ship, and she was the person that many people on the island came to for advice, just about everyday living issues, and she was influential in their church, and her family had been instrumental, her parents' generation had been instrumental in starting the Presbyterian Church that is still on the island.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather held many of the offices on the island at one time or another.
Hmm.
So they did wield quite a bit of influence there.
But no strong, deep, deep ties to government where they would have had some kind of, former knowledge that was going to be happening.
No.
Mm-hmm.
They were basically farmers. That was the big thing. But it was just, they just did their civic duty now and then. I know that later on my grandfather was a justice of the peace at one point when they were up in Sandy Lake. But they weren't really political.
Did everybody lose their land on Neville Island at that time?
I think pretty much. There were already some factories. I think American Steel and Wire, or one of those companies, another one of the U.S. steel companies, had bought some land from my great-grandfather, and they were located at the far end of the island. In fact, one of their foremen was, his family was a very close friend of my grandparents, and their kids kind of grew up together until the point where the poor gentleman, as part of his job, had to walk out on the catwalk over these steel vats,
mm-hmm.
Where they're boiling down. down.
Oh, my gosh.
And he fell in.
Oh, God.
So the family, that family moved back to the wife's parents in Ohio, I think it was, and just sort of lost track. But, yeah, there were businesses and things going on at the other end of the island, but that whole eastern end was all farms.
Farms.
And I think there were still some other, maybe smaller farms and some houses somewhere at the other end. And at one point, too, part of the government's plan was to build all these little houses for the workers that were going to come and work in this munitions factory. So it would be this ideal city that they were going to build with these little matchbox houses. And apparently Carnegie Steel carried through some of that plan, because when I visited there a year ago, there were a lot of small, little close-together houses there at the far end of the island.
Mm-hmm. Housing for their workers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
So there's one old farmhouse still there in the middle of the, I guess, sort of you can call it a village, but it had no land around it. I mean, just a little...
Just the old farmhouse.
Yeah, just an old farmhouse. And it wasn't as big a one as the ones that my grandparents... great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents had.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it kind of sticks out as a bit of an anomaly around there.
Yeah, we talked to some of the people that were around. You know, it was nice weather. There were people outside. We got into conversations, and they pointed it out.
Mm.
That's the only one left. But they didn't really know much about the farms that had been on the eastern end.
Yeah,
they just
sure.
knew that there had been some big asparagus farms up there long ago, but beyond that, they didn't know anything.
They didn't know the history, right? Okay, so now in Stolen Fields, you really go into detail about how losing this land had a direct effect on that current family and then continued to affect the later generations. So why did you feel that you really wanted to go into such detail with the effects of this?
Well, because I think when people hear about things like this happening, they don't think about how it affects the people that it happens to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just, oh, well, okay, that's in the news today. Poor people lost their home, lost their business, whatever. You know,
right. Wasn't me.
But this sort of puts the human face on it.
Yeah.
And this is what happened to one family. And it's not every family's story, but it's one family, and each family that happens to, I'm sure, has their own story.
So have you had a lot of families that have been affected by eminent domain contact you because
no,
of...
No, not yet, but I am looking into it. I do have a blog on my website about eminent domain issues, and I've just started it actually a few weeks ago, but I will be developing that more and more, and I hope that people will tune into that and respond with comments and get a real dialogue going about that, because I've heard more and more about that, and I'm reading up on it. I'm going to make myself much more knowledgeable about eminent domain. And I joined Castle Coalition, which has a blog called Castle Watch, and they have a lot of information about the Kelo case down in New London, Connecticut, as well as other cases around the country. And there are things going on around the country at any given time.
Yeah.
It's always with us, and we just don't realize that it could happen to you next.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Established in 1998, Rebecca's Reads is a book review and publicity service serving a large reading audience, as well as a wide community of authors, publishers, publicists, and buyers and sellers. They offer reviews of recently published books, as well as chapter readings, teasers, and videos to help you decide what book you would like to read next. Their insightful author interviews take connecting reader and author one step further, and if you decide you would like to purchase a book, an easy-to-navigate link will allow you to purchase the book immediately online. For the authors, publicists, and publishers, Rebecca's Reads has a variety of publicity services to help them market their books to their reading audience. Their services are budget-friendly and effective. For buyers and sellers, they have a monthly list of current reviews in the Book Review Index for easy browsing, as they know your time is precious and efficiency is a priority.
Be sure to visit RebeccasReads.com and browse around their new space. Whatever your literary need, this user-friendly website may be just what you're looking for. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Jean Boggio, author of Stolen Fields, A Story of Eminent Domain and the Death of the American Dream. You can find out more about Jean through her website, jeanboggio.com. I think one of the problems with this issue, and you would probably agree, is that we just don't hear about this in the media. So this is something that we have to hear from friends of friends or someone directly involved with this. You know, it's not something that we're seeing news reports on. So really websites and blogs and that sort of thing is how this information is getting out. I mean, I live in Texas, and I know it's a big issue in Texas with this a big Trans-Texas corridor that they want to build. So it's like a huge road, and they're taking a lot of people's land here in Texas.
In Texas also, I've been reading this book called Bulldozed, which was about the Kelo case, but it also was about a situation in Galveston, which it was going on there. They were taking these people's seafood business. They had a seafood processing business there, and they wholesaled the seafood, and so there were many shrimp boats that were dependent on them. But because they wanted to improve the city, they wanted to take over this company. And again, it was an issue of they weren't paying what it was worth.
Yeah.
And, they were going to take these people's livelihoods that had been started by the grandfather of the current owner. Then everything kind of went on hold. I've only just started this book, so I don't know the whole story yet, but it kind of went on hold when the Kelo case hit the news, because that somehow made national headlines.
Oh, wow.
More so. Pfizer was involved in it. And so they put that on hold, but of course I think it continued on after that, since it went against Kelo. As far as I understand, nothing has really happened yet, but the decision went against them. But even right here in Maine, my daughter just told me a couple of weeks ago that they're going to be building a big new east-to-west highway.
Yeah.
And they're already talking about invoking eminent domain to take the land.
It's happening all over the country, and it's a big issue. And one thing I think is so important about this book that you've written is it really does kind of chronicle the effects that has on family and people, and how it can basically change their mindset. And I know that in your book, you really chronicle the strongest experience losing the land was felt by your great-grandmother, your grandfather, and your Uncle Bob. So if you can talk a little bit to how they changed because of this.
Well, my great-grandmother just became very sad, and she'd been such a forceful woman, and now her influence was gone. She was now living, the house they lived in on Neville Island, the house was divided because she and my grandmother didn't get along. But they each had, the house was big enough that they could easily do that without crossing swords at all. But when they moved up to Sandy Lake, and they did get a nice farm up there and renovated it and moved into it. But my grandmother, my great-grandmother was then relegated to a small back bedroom. And my Uncle Ned, the younger son, tells how her mind just kind of went in her older years. She would just lay there in bed and look out across the asparagus fields, because they continued to raise asparagus up there. And she would just be seeing those boats going down. You know, look, Ned, there's the Aliquippa going down. And he would just nod and say, just sort of go along with her, and she'd be satisfied. And that's where she died. And my grandfather, he became somewhat bitter, but he just, you know, he was just beginning to feel like a loser because he lost that. And he had other money, but he also gambled a lot on the stock market and invested a lot in the Titus Well oil fields, which, of course, now who knows of the Titusville oil fields. They dried up. And so he just was not real good at making money, so this was just a huge brick on the pile of problems that he had there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it just sort of twisted him a little bit, too, in some of his thinking. And, of course, the book brings out that he sort of went after the female, some of the younger female members of the family.
Yeah.
I don't know whether he would have done that anyway or whether his mind just sort of
he lost it a bit.
Direction.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to tell about that part of it. But he was always just dwelling on trying on his lawsuits. For the rest of his life, he had lawsuits against the government just trying to get a fair price for his land, and of course he never did.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, when he was 88, and he was living with my aunt and her family, and one night he swallowed Pine Sol and died.
Oh, my gosh.
And the story was that, well, he got up in the middle of the night and thought it was something else, but I don't know how you could possibly confuse Pine Sol with anything else.
No. That's a very strong smell.
And especially when they found all his blood pressure pills hidden under his mattress.
Oh, wow.
That he hadn't been taking.
Oh, gosh.
So I think it was just he was in despair at
that
point.
Yeah.
And my older uncle, he, I think, had the worst development there, and he got the family religion all mixed up into it and turned it into a thing of just rigidity and fire and brimstone and raised his children really by the rod and to really cruel. And I remember once when my mother wanted to bring my oldest cousin back home with us after a summer visit in order to spend a couple of weeks with us. And he would not let her go because he was sure we were going to corrupt her.
Mm.
And he wouldn't let the girls take gym because the gym suits were immoral and, you know, that kind of thing. And he allowed the oldest cousin to marry this man that was much older than herself who worked for him and was one of his good workers and lived right down the road in a little cabin with an outhouse. And she was only about 16, and it wasn't that she wanted to marry him, but he wanted to marry her, and so my uncle approved it, and she ended up being beaten and all sorts of stuff, and finally escaped. One day, he would lock her into the house when he would leave to go to work, and finally one day she escaped and ran back home, and so my uncle took her back, and I guess he must have fired the guy, I don't know but what happened to the guy, but... as my cousin said, he figured one workhorse was as good as another, and she certainly was a workhorse. He just was very cruel to his wife when he married. And my mother said, well, he thinks he's getting another workhorse there because the woman he married was rather large, but it turned out she had a lot of health issues. She was diabetic and what all else. But he worked her to death. And my cousin told me that their mother was expected to be up in the morning before everybody and not allowed to go to bed until after everybody else had gone to bed because she was there to serve.
Wow.
And for the first few years, my grandparents were still living at the farm as well. And my grandmother was just as bad as he was in treatment of her. And she finally died way before her time. And when she died, my younger uncle stopped by the farm and found nobody home, and which was odd because at that point her health was so poor that she wasn't really able to leave the house that much as his. She was always home. And so he went through the house looking for somebody. He found her dead in the little back bedroom.
Mm.
And shortly after that, his brother, my older uncle, returned home with a car full of groceries because he had to have food to feed all the people that would be coming. He hadn't even called any officials or anybody, notified anybody, not even the undertaker or anything.
Wow.
He found her dead and, okay, we've got to feed all these people.
Get on with it. Oh, geez.
Yep.
So, Jean, what was your experience, you know, so many generations later living with that family story, and how has it kind of trickled down to affect the newer generation?
Well, my mother was, she was the romantic of the family. And she just, I think, lived in her books and her dream world. And I don't know what the first influence was on her that made her turn to this, but she decided she was going to be a French teacher. and get away from the farm. That was her big goal, get away from the farm. She didn't want to live the rest of her life there in that. And she did, but she always had this illusion about Neville Island. And my sister and I grew up with this thing about big houses and wealthy people. And my mother was always very impressed by people that she would meet in her church work and that sort of thing. That had these big houses, and they would often go to teas at these places, and she would just really become focused on this social status, and it just sort of spilled down through our whole lives. I mean, I still like big houses. That's why I moved to Maine and renovated this house. Putting me in the poorhouse. But it was this status thing, and what will people think?
Think, yeah.
Because that was, they had their position there on Neville Island. They had to maintain, and they were like the premier family on the island, and they had to be the role model for everybody. So I grew up with that. What will people think?
Isn't that, and that would, that ends up really, kind of being at the root of probably a lot of choices that you've made in your life. I mean, it's so interesting how just sort of basic, I don't know, points of view or just views of the world can shape a whole life.
I think that with me, I was always afraid to jump off the cliff, so to speak. I just always had this caution because of what the neighbors might think or whatever.
Now, did you ever fear losing everything? Mm-hmm. Did you ever fear losing everything?
No, because at that point, I didn't, when I was first starting out, I didn't have that much to lose. So I wanted to have something.
Yeah.
And it was, like follow a career in theater or have regular meals.
Mm-hmm.
I opted for regular meals.
Yeah.
I always wonder what would have happened if I had gone the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing is that I have recently reconnected with my old college friend from Allegheny, and she followed the theater thing because we both majored in drama. And she has had a wonderful artistic career that's been very satisfying to her in various aspects of theater and art and whatever. And I kind of envy her. She didn't give up the dream.
Mm-hmm. Well, you just never know, though.
Financial success, I think, but she made she was satisfied with her life, I believe.
That's great. So I've heard that you are actually going to be writing another book on eminent domain.
I am thinking I would like to. I would like to hear from other people. That's one of the reasons I started that blog. So hopefully I can hear from other people who have had this experience, and maybe the other book might be either my writing up things that I hear from them or an anthology of things other people have written about their experiences. But I want it, again, to be the human aspect and have it be more people than just my family to show that this can happen to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Would you be focusing more on current issues of it, or
yeah.
Interesting. I think an anthology of stories would be fantastic. That's a great, great idea. So what about for people who don't read a lot, aren't apt to really pick up a book? Are you really expecting your blog to take off? Are you going to put a lot of energy into that?
I would like to. That's one thing. Another thing might be down the road producing some audio books.
Because
one of my friends at work, he's telling me he's not going to buy a copy of my book until he's waiting for the audio version to come out because he likes to listen instead of to read. So that's a thought. I'm not going to go out and produce one audio book for one person.
No, of course not.
But there's a market for it. But it's just I can only do one thing at a time.
Of course. It's a big, big project. And there's also podcasts that you can do and put that kind of thing up online. I mean, there's so many ways to get out there and get this information out there.
I need to be able to connect with people who have experienced it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's one of my goals.
Well, we certainly encourage people to go to your website and check out your blog. And just for people that are maybe at their computers right now, your website is jeanbaggio.com. And I hope I'm pronouncing your last name correctly.
Boggio.
Boggio. Okay. Yeah. So you allude to the death of the American dream in your title. So, of course, I have to ask you this. Are you jaded at this point about the American dream? What does the term American dream mean to you at this point?
Well, I think at that point it was that everybody, you know, should owning your own property and having the autonomy. Property rights were supposedly a big thing. But right now, property rights have gotten fewer and fewer as the years have moved on. So I think the nature of the American dream might have changed at this point, because our whole world has changed. So it's not each person living as independently as they would like. You know, the more laws and rules that we have, the less of that American dream of freedom we have. But to make something of a satisfying life, a satisfying and useful success of your life, I think that still is part of the American dream. And the way I keep going from one thing to the other, I guess I'm not jaded yet.
Do you have any fear about some of the laws that are being passed these days by the government that really seem to be infringing on the freedoms that were once laid down as a part of that American dream? Do you fear that at all?
I don't like it. I don't know if fear is quite the word, because I'm not, you know, living here in terror.
No, I realize that.
but I don't like it. We've had to give up a lot of freedoms since the 9/11 situation. I understand this is for national safety and that there are measures that they want to take to protect people. But on the other hand, every time you institute another rule, then that's another freedom that's lost, and I don't think you ever get them back.
Good point.
I think they need to be more careful, and I think some of the 9/11 stuff they did was overkill.
Good point. Now, you had brought up the whole idea you mentioned earlier in the interview, but the whole idea of incest, it ended up happening in your family. So how much emphasis did you want to put on incest in this book? How did you bring it out? And do you think that will be an issue that kind of falls by the wayside, pit it up against the eminent domain issue?
I hope it doesn't fall by the wayside either, because when I started this book, I didn't really know about that.
Oh, really?
This is something that came out while I was writing the book. My sister had mentioned something maybe a few years ago about our grandfather, how he had, when she was a teenager and he was living with my aunt, that he was sitting out in the backyard and had pulled her down into his lap, and she felt very uncomfortable and struggled and yelled and got away. But my grandmother came running out of the house and screaming and shrieking at him and carrying on like a banshee. And my sister said she thought at the time that he had, that my grandmother had overreacted. And I just sort of dismissed the whole thing because I just didn't want to know about stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started writing the book, my cousin told me about what happened to her. And she wanted it publicized. She wanted it known. She wanted it out there that maybe it would help somebody else, what he had done to her when she was a little girl. She wasn't a teenager.
Mm.
And so I went back to my sister and now looked at this as a truth. And my sister told me that after that, she'd mentioned it to our mother. And our mother told my sister that, her mother, my grandmother, had warned her away from him when she was a teenager because apparently he'd gone after her older sister.
Wow.
So my grandmother knew all this and was keeping this
a secret,
a deep, dark secret.
Yeah.
There. And nobody ever thought to tell my little cousin when she was like 8 or 9 years old.
Oh, God.
And he started bribing her. Started with a quarter and then 50 cents and so forth. And it never went too far, but it went far enough that she... You know, before she drew the line, I reached a point where she just wasn't going to go any further with it. But it was far enough that it colored many years subsequently in her life until really just recently. I mean, that's a long part of one's life.
I imagine. Well, that's the developmental years, and even if it wasn't, you know, years and years of abuse, you know, certain select, you know, situations like that can be very damaging.
Yeah, because she thought it was her fault. She felt guilty. She had been guilty all those years.
Yes.
And she did say something to her parents finally, but I don't think she doesn't remember what she told her parents, but I don't think she told them the whole story because knowing her mother, you know, my uncle's wife, she was quite not a shy violet at all. And as I told my cousin, you know, her mother would have been up there with a meat cleaver if she'd known what he was up to.
Gosh. It's interesting how it was your grandmother, was that again, that knew about it but kept it a secret?
Yes. And then my Uncle Bob, my cousin, told me that he went after his granddaughters.
Oh.
And when she said she doesn't think he went after any of his own daughters, but he went after a couple of his granddaughters. Mm. And when she found out about it, they would have been her nieces.
Mm-hmm.
She cornered him after church one day and told him she knew about it, and that if it didn't stop, she'd put him away.
Mm-hmm.
And she was forceful enough that it stopped.
Oh, that's so interesting. So I know on your website you're also creating a blog around incest, so there's a lot of information up there.
But people aren't willing to come for. Nobody's commented except my cousin. You know, something like, thank you for...
Well, it's still pretty new, so it'll take some time to get out there. Interesting. So you are doing a bunch of events coming up in June and I think July and August of this year, 2008. So
yes.
That's so exciting for you. You must just be thrilled.
Oh, I am. I can hardly wait. The old drama major in me coming to the front now.
That's great. Well, I know all of those dates are up on your website, jeanbogio.com, as well. So, well, it's been so great talking with you today. What an informative interview, and this book sounds really, really fantastic. I mean, you know, where you're taking us into your family history, but this is very pertinent information for today. So it's very relevant to readers right now.
Yes, it is.
So do you have any final thoughts today, Jean, before we close up?
Well, my brain is pretty well drained.
I know. I really picked it today, didn't I? That's okay. You don't have to have any final thoughts. I just want to thank you for your time. It's been wonderful, and best to you, and I hope you have a lot of success. You know, we really encourage people to check out your blogs because this is a time where we really need to be communicating about these issues. So thank you for the work that you're doing.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you very much for inviting me here today, and I have really enjoyed it.
Great. Thanks, Jean. Take care. All right, listeners, I have been talking with Jean Boccio. Her new book, Stolen Fields, A Story of Eminent Domain and the Death of the American Dream, is available through her website, jeanbogio.com, and that's spelled Jean, JeanBoggio.com. And her book signings, all of her events are listed up on her website, links to her blog. She's got quite a bit of information up there, so please do check it out. So thank you once again for listening to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.